Welcome to Comic Talk Today for Tuesday, September 24th, 2019. I'm Martin. Joining me is the person I hope to be, and I don't know how much older you are than me. We'll just say 15 years. That's probably about right.
Well, I just turned 58 last Tuesday, so...
All right, in 20 years.
Okay, I was probably closer to 20 years.
Jay Lovin, welcome.
Thank you. Gosh, I finally made it onto Comic Talk Today.
Is this your first time?
Yeah.
Surely not.
It is.
I don't believe it.
Okay, well, go back and look.
I'm going to have to check my notes that I don't keep.
Well, I am 58, so my memory's going, so maybe you're right. So,
man, I can't believe it. All right, well, good. Welcome to your first Comic Talk Today. That's unreal. I could have sworn you've been on this. You're the perfect person to have on this show. Because I kicked this around on Twitter, and people seemed to be interested, and I was surprised. Because the topic we're going to be discussing tonight seems like something that nobody gives two craps about. But I know that you do, and I know that I do. So that's why I invited you on. We're going to talk about comic distribution. Everyone clap. Everyone's like, what the hell is happening on this show? Martin goes away for 3 months, and now he's talking about comic distribution. I think it's a fascinating topic.
I do too, but I mean, the whole history of comics is just fascinating to me. I mean, anybody who hasn't studied, especially the early days of the Golden Age, that is such a wild, raucous, crime-ridden. I mean, it's insane, that story. Anybody would, I think, benefit from learning about that, but alas, not all do.
I've talked about this somewhat publicly before on Twitter. I know different podcasters have different experiences. I've been fortunate enough to garner some relationships with certain folks in the industry. And, man, some of the stories you hear sometimes, you're like, holy crap. Like, if I had known this, like, I would not read comics. You know what I mean? Like, growing up, being a little kid, like, there's nobody should ever tell their kids insider baseball comic book industry stories.
No, they shouldn't.
It is crazy. It's very cutthroat. And in particular, I would say comic distribution is very cutthroat. So the reason that I wanted to have you on here is you have done some reading in the near past, kind of about this topic. You love comic book history. I love comic book history. And the good thing about you is that you sometimes take notes on stuff you read and listen to. I never do. So, perfect.
Okay, yeah.
You're the man. I'm telling you, you're like who I want to be in 20 years. We're the gin buddies. We love Batman.
Yes.
We love old comics. We love all comics. And I don't wear a hat yet, but one day.
I know, but you've shaved your head now, so you're getting towards – that's closer to me. So
it's grown back. I haven't shaved it back.
Oh, okay. Well,
I felt a little inappropriate.
I understand.
Yeah, but it's good. It's all good. So I sent you a link right before we started recording that you didn't know existed. That's kind of how I brushed up on some of my history. There's actually a couple interesting articles online that I read, so I'm going to put those in the show notes for everyone that would like to read those. One is at delusionalhonesty.com. That I think has a really great rundown of 60, 70 years worth of comic book distribution history. The other one is from Jim Shooter's website. I know you love Jim. I love Jim.
Yes.
I got to meet Jim one time. I felt – it's kind of weird. I felt a little starstruck, and I don't know why. But he was very nice.
Everything I've seen him, everybody says he's nice, other than the people who used to work for him, I guess.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? You always hear these stories about Jim Shooter being such a stickler and so difficult to work with. I mean, maybe that's true, but at least when I've seen him at a convention, he was very pleasant and had almost no lines, so that was beautiful.
Yes.
That was beautiful, and which is surprising. I mean, I guess Jim hasn't really done a whole lot in comics in, I don't know, 20 years maybe? What would be the last big thing? The last big thing would be like Broadway comics, right?
I believe so. Or whatever, or Defiant.
Let me look this up, because I think Defiant was after Valiant.
It was.
And then after Defiant went under, he did Broadway Comics.
Okay.
Which, oddly enough, was funded by the SNL guy. What's that guy's name? Lorne Michaels.
Lorne Michaels, okay.
Yeah. I haven't watched SNL in years.
But
I do know that at the end of when the show ends, they actually show the Broadway Entertainment logo. And that was the same logo that Broadway Comics used to use. So that's very odd. I think Broadway Comics didn't even last very long, right? They had like one or two issues of like three series, and that's it.
I didn't follow them, so I couldn't say.
Oh, man. I followed them just because Shooter was there. That's the only reason I bought Defiant Comics, and the only reason I bought Broadway Comics. I was like, Shooter? Yep, I'm in. They weren't great. Like, let's be real. Defiant wasn't great. Broadway Comics was not that great. The only Broadway comic I remember is Fatale. It's this girl in leather pants, which is awesome because I was like 12. You know what I mean? So I was like, hell yeah, chicks in leather pants. That was hot back then too, right? Because you had Shy, you had Lady Death, you had like all those like mean girl comics.
Right.
Witchblade. Oh god, I loved Witchblade. I still love Witchblade. Before we get to our topic, Jay.
Yes.
You're a Batman fan. We do a Batman podcast. Go listen to the Bat Pod with Bill Beer as well. Sometimes Ronnie Barron. But there's some rumors going around, and I wanted to get your thoughts. Not so much on the rumor, because I don't really care about that. Jonah Hill's supposed to be either a Joker or not Joker, Riddler or the Penguin in the new Batman movie, The Batman. And my question to you, Jay, is why the hell do we keep on having Riddler and in Joker or Penguin in all the Batman movies? Doesn't Batman have one of the most diverse rogue galleries of any villain or of any comic book hero? Why always the same stuff?
My first inclination, and I do tend towards being a little cynical, is that the studios underestimate the intelligence of their audience.
Hmm.
I think part of it is, yeah, even if you don't read comic books, most people know who Batman is. Probably almost as many people could tell you who Joker is. And I think they're afraid to go with, bring in characters that are lesser known. I'm afraid that the audience is going to say, who is this? I remember Penguin. I remember Riddler, but I don't remember Tin-Eyed Man. Or,
I mean, how could you forget Tin-Eyed Man? He's the best.
I think the Ventriloquist would be a great on-screen villain.
So, I hadn't thought about that, but I was going back and forth a little bit before I started recording on Twitter with Andrew Shaw. Go pick up Cul-de-Sac, available in Comixology. It's great. But I was talking to him, and he mentioned he wanted either Man-Bat or Clayface, which I think would be really interesting. My choices would be Man-Bat or Ra's al Ghul, Ra's, as the kids call him. Because to me, like the whole Dark Knight trilogy thing, like that was not really Ra's al Ghul, right?
No.
It was some guy kind of pretending to be Ra's al Ghul. Not that Liam Neeson didn't do a good job, but that wasn't really Ra's. I would love to see that. Some of the other ones that I would love to see would be like Calendar Man, Clock King, Mad Hatter, those kind of guys. Where you can, like, really do some cool psychological stuff, right? When we had, what was the first Nolan Batman? Batman Begins. You had Scarecrow in there. I thought, like, to me, that was a great Scarecrow. And I don't think we've seen Scarecrow in movies previous to that. But it was a really cool, interesting take, and I think it did the character justice by making him so cerebral and creepy. I think they could have gone a little bit further, but I thought it was a fantastic Scarecrow. It felt like one of the original iterations of Scarecrow, where he was like super creepy. And that went well. Like, who knows about Scarecrow? Nobody knows right. Scarecrow. So you can have that and make it make sense and have people react well to it. His thing with Man-Bat is he's afraid you end up with something like the Lizard from Amazing Spider-Man. And I totally get that, but like we've had that with Batman films also. right? The Clooney Batman and the Val Kilmer Batman, like, those weren't the greatest. And the villains, the portrayal of the villains, felt a lot more like kooky, like Batman 66 kind of villains than something that would, I think, fit well in the modern era.
Right. Well, the other thing that I've noticed, that I've always thought about, if you think about it, other than the very first Batman movie with Michael Keaton in 89, there hasn't been a Batman movie that hasn't had at least two villains in it. They seem to not want to have just focus on one villain other than, say, the first one where Jack Nicholson played the Joker. And that, you know, when you're talking about 2.5, maybe 3 hours, knock my buck off, you know, that's a lot to bring into a movie when you haven't trying to, unless you do something that's, I think Nolan did it best with Scarecrow, who was kind of a, he was a, affected the plot, but he was minor compared to Ra's al Ghul and the rest of the story. So I don't know. That's just an interesting thing I've always found is like, we kind of have two villains or three even sometimes. And I think then you're getting it really watered down if you go more than two.
That's the problem I had with some of the early Spider-Man movies is they all had two or three villains.
Right.
And I'm like, do you just not have the proper producing staff or writing staff to make these villains stand out on their own that you need to team them up with somebody else? Or have like the one bad guy and then the bigger bad guy? I don't know. I think maybe we're at a point where comic movies can be taken more seriously, right? I mean, say whatever you will about the MCU, but I think the level of storytelling that a comic book movie can tell now is above and beyond what we would have gotten 20 years ago. For the simple fact that, you know, people may not know who the characters are, but you're used to seeing this kind of like epic storytelling that builds up over years. And I wish that we do that with some of these other ones, especially DC, man. They've had so many issues with people not liking their movies. I think they're wrong. I've enjoyed all of them, but I don't know. I would like something else. And, you know, this guy's doing different things, right? Like, Robert Pattinson as Batman, that's an odd choice. I like it. I've seen some photoshops of him as Batman. I think it looks great. I think they're pitching, like, an African-American Commissioner Gordon. That's cool. We haven't seen that before. So why do Riddler or Penguin again? That's just, ugh. They're not even the most interesting, you know what I mean? They're not interesting villains to me. I'm sure some people love those guys. But to me, they're not the most interesting.
Right. I don't know. It just depends on how they're written and what the story is. I mean, I don't have an answer to that question, why they seem to come in with the same characters when there's so many great ones to choose from.
If you had to pick a Batman villain for your dream Batman movie, who would it be?
Oh, gosh. I almost have to say... Boy, Ra's is hard to beat because Ra's is such an intellectual equivalent of Batman and Bruce Wayne. That's what I'd go with. Ra's, but Ra's done differently than he was done in The Dark and Batman Begins.
Yeah. Matter of fact, I'll be talking about Ra's. I don't know who Ra's is, but I know Ra's.
Oh, Ra's.
I'll be talking to him about him a little bit on the next Batpod as one of my Bronze Age picks.
I don't know why I said Ra's. I hate it as much as you do. You mentioned it as the kids mentioned it. So
you've been hanging out with the millennials.
Oh, God.
Very good.
I don't know. I mean, there's so many, but yeah, that one, because you could bring, yeah, you could do so much into that, into a film. I mean, you bring Talia in there to add some plot implications. I don't know. It just, it's.
Yeah, you gotta have a love interest. Perfect. I love it. Make this happen, whoever's making this movie.
Yes. Give us Birth of the Demon.
God, it's so good. Birth of the Demon's really good. It's got that really weird, that really weird side character, who I think, like, they probably started right as a love interest, but then they killed her off. I don't know how much you remember that story, but they had that Olympic skier that was helping Batman, like, track down Ra's for some reason in Tibet.
Right.
Yeah, really good, really weird. Actually, really cool, too, because isn't that the first appearance of Matches Malone also?
It may be. I think so.
Yeah. I think that first issue of Birth of the Demon is the first appearance of Matches Malone, and he dies in that issue. And then he ends up being, you know, a little more integral to Batman years down the line. That whole thing's weird. Like, Dick Grayson dresses up as Matches Malone in that story.
Yes.
Because they're trying – he's trying to enlist some gangsters to go track Graz. And the way he does it is by having Dick dress up as Matches Malone after Matches gets killed.
Right.
Really odd. Anyways, very good. I like it. Make Roz a thing. Let's get on to our topic.
Okay.
Let me tell you the reason why I came up with this the other day. I don't know if you're familiar with the publisher Wave Blue World.
I've heard of them. Not any more than that, though.
Okay, so I found out through about them through an anthology series that they did. Friend of the show, Andrew Shaw, had a story in it. Andrew Rahal had a story in it. It was put together by Matt Miner, who does some amazing work. I don't know if you read Poser that he put out last year. It was really good. Eric Palicki. Is one of the guys that put it together as well. Anyways, I really enjoy their work. They're I want to say they're local to the Southeast because they were at Heroes Con last year as well. But they just announced they penned a distribution deal with Diamond, and it's one of those things where, like, when you see a publisher, you never think, like, how are they getting their books out to people, right? And these guys were doing, like, basically an online shop or, like, Kickstarters and stuff like that to distribute their stuff. But then you have other folks like Alterna that have really interesting distribution models. And I want to talk about Alterna a little bit later in the episode because I think they do some really interesting stuff. But not everyone puts their books out through Diamond. And I think Diamond has become so integral to the comic book industry that, I mean, for one, I'm sure a lot of people don't give two craps about Diamond. But two, like, for people that are kind of in the know of how things work, you never think twice, right? Like, if you're getting a comic, I'm sure Diamond sent it here somehow, right? Obviously, if you're buying it at a shop, Diamond sent it there. But outside of that, like, you don't really think about it. I always just assume, like, if I'm reading a comic, Diamond somehow sent it to me. Or had their hands in getting it sent to me. As long as it's not a Kickstarter, of course.
Right.
But that was not always the case. And you're a little bit older than I am, so maybe you remember some of this stuff. By the time I got involved in comics, we were probably down to, like, three distributors, I want to say. Because this would have been early 90s. So there weren't very many. I think there were, like, a handful of distributors, but, like, they got their books from a bigger distributor.
Right.
Right? So I think there was, like, a East Coast and a West Coast distributor, and then there were, like, local distributors, either for a state or a collection of states within an area. Of course, that's no longer the case.
No.
And it wasn't the case before. And it had me really thinking about a lot of stuff. And I do wonder, and I wanted to get your opinion before we get into some of this history stuff maybe. I do wonder if we had more than Diamond, would comics be in a better place or in a worse place?
That's hard to answer. I mean, if I read and done some research on where most local comic shop owners, what their opinions are, and the vast number of them seem to think, oh, we're better off with one because I only have to deal with one. But I actually brought this up to my local comic shop owner named Jeremy of Titan Comics in Dallas. Give them a plug. And I was saying, you know, a lot of – he's of the opinion, no, it's not good for business because with one distributor, you've got no incentive for innovation or, you know, doing things better, and we're simply going on the same model that has been going on since 1996. That was when Diamond became it and only it. And, I mean, think of how technology has changed, how culture has changed in those years, and we're still basically going on that same model. And it's not, according to him, it's not doing that well. And I'm just like, well, a lot of publishers, a lot of comic book store owners So they don't want to deal with more than one distributor. And he just made a comment off the cuff. Well, I'm already dealing with more than one distributor. And I didn't know what he meant. I didn't have time to ask because it was a Wednesday and he was busy, new comic book day. But I know he's dealing with more than one because he carries, well, for instance, he carries TKO books in his store. So he's getting those from somewhere. He's not getting those from Diamond because they're bypassing Diamond.
Yeah, too. I think TKO does their own distribution.
Right.
Yeah.
So the logical part of me says would have to be better for business to have more than one. Competition always tends to bring about more innovation.
You know, it's funny that you brought up TKO because I'm pretty sure that Sei Chung talked about that at the TKO panel at C2E2. I don't remember like the specifics, but of course, like you can go to their website, and I like the model, right? You can buy either the entire series in single issues, or you can buy the trade. I think that's a really interesting way to do it because you can kind of hit both sides of the market, right? You can hit the trade waiters, and you can hit the people that want to buy single issues, mostly collectors. And you get them in this like cool collectible box. So I think that's awesome. But they do have, they do deal with shops directly. And right. I think the way that that's done is almost through like a consignment deal. I don't want to say exactly like, but very similar to how comics were distributed probably until the early 60s. And still how magazines are distributed. So if you go to like, I don't know, CVS or Walmart or whatever, some local supermarket, those places aren't purchasing those magazines that they have on the racks, right? And the reason that they're placed at the front like that is because that's the only way people are going to buy them, right? As kind of an additional purchase, like, oh, that cover looks cool. Oh my God, Jennifer Aniston, what? I'm going to pick this book up. But those places don't actually pay for those magazines. They actually get credit when somebody buys them. So if I'm at the checkout line and I buy the most amazing latest issue of the National Enquirer, which of course I would never do, then you know that counts as a sale, and that supermarket gets charged the $3.99. Okay, well, not $3.99, whatever it'd be, like $2, let's say. And then everything else that they don't sell at the end of the week when the new books come in, they send back, right? You either tear the cover off or something similar to that, and those unsold copies get sent back. That's kind of how comics used to work. Matter of fact, almost exactly how comics used to work.
Yes, except I think they did pay for them simply because there wasn't the technology to, you know, they would the newsstand, where it was, yeah, the publisher would print the comics, sell it to a magazine and news distributor. Who then they had their end clients, newsstands, drugstores, candy stores, that type of thing. Small mom and pop places with the spinner racks. And then they would report any unsolds back. And they would originally the plain thing was to tear the cover off. It's in the cover back as proof of these are unsold copies. Later on, it got even more simple than that. All I had to do was report it to the distributor. And the distributor sent an affidavit back to the publisher saying we've unsold this number of copies. And that's when the thing got really rife with fraud because, hey, the guy would say, nope, sorry, I didn't sell any comics this week. And then he'd get credit for them. And then he'd sell them out the back door.
Right.
And keep all the profits. So it was but that's also back when comics were, you know, 10 and 12 cents a piece. We're talking about pennies. Everybody was making just pennies of profit off of each comic book. But of course, the sales were much more than they are today. We're talking about millions of copies before kids had 1,000 different things pulling for their attention. So.
Well, and what's really interesting is how changing the model from, you know, just send back whatever you don't sell to actually having a distributor do that for you. Because, of course, like, this was a great deal for comic shop, or not for comic shop, for comic publishers. Right, because you're guaranteed to sell a certain amount. Right, the distributor's like, send me 10,000 copies.
Right,
right, and so you know we'll guarantee you this much, and that's great for a publisher because they don't have to worry about well, what do I do with unsold stuff? You know, a lot of that stuff has changed in the way that returns are handled. Many publishers don't even do returns. Right, like Marvel and DC very rarely do returns.
Yeah.
Very rarely. Some of the smaller publishers have some really interesting return policies. I think IDW, if I'm not mistaken, and Aftershock have done this, where like you're guaranteed a certain amount, right? We'll give you a deal. You purchased 100 copies, and we'll give them to you for $1 a piece. And then, you know, anything over like 75 copies you don't sell, you can send back.
Right.
Which, I mean, I would say for the publisher ends up being pretty good. They might lose a little bit of money if they don't sell those, but because it's so cheap to print these books, they're not losing a bunch. And then, of course, it's great for the shops because they know, like, hey, I want to try this new series out. I don't have to worry about having to eat the cost, right? Because when they place the order, Diamond puts it on their invoice. They have to pay this invoice. And, of course, if you don't sell the comics, you're not selling them at $3.99. You might sell them at $2.99 or, you know, end up putting them in a dollar bin or a 50-cent bin and take them to conventions that way.
Right.
And sometimes you might get lucky and there's one that hits really big, but those, of course, are very few and far between.
Right. But yeah, you're right. The publishers, especially the big two, they haven't done returns since the direct market took over in the early to mid-70s.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the last time one did was in 2016. At the very beginning of Rebirth, DC made, I think, their stuff returnable for the first few issues because they were wanting everybody to try as many of the titles as they want and say, buy all these titles and we'll return the ones you don't, you know.
That was a really exciting time, man, because the books were cheap. Like, granted, they were coming out twice a month.
Right.
But that's not the way people think, right? You're like, holy shit, a $1.99 comic? Yes. Even though you're still paying, or whatever it was, $2.99. You're paying $6 a month now instead of $4, but you're getting twice the comic, right? That seems like a pretty good deal. But yeah, that was hot, man. Like, DC was top of the charts for like a year and a half when Rebirth came out. They were leaving Marvel in the dust. And of course, that kind of leads to another issue that I have with Diamond being the only game in town is that I just said DC was the top of the charts for a year. Well, of course, that means absolutely nothing because sales charts that we get from Diamond mean absolutely nothing. That's a thing that I always try to bring up whenever I get into this kind of discussion. You know, some people love a certain book, right? They'd be like, oh my God, Spider-Man sold 100,000 copies. Well, did they? Like, are 100,000 people reading Spider-Man? Because obviously not. When you get to issue 2 or issue 3, you have, you know, 50,000, 35,000 people reading it, right? What happened to the other 65,000 people? They didn't just quit buying Spider-Man because they hated the first issue. So those sales charts are a little iffy, and I do wonder if we had more than one, if they were just one more, if we had two distributors, if we would have better sales data, right? Because part of the problem is, since Diamond's been the only game in town for 3 years, they haven't had to do anything, right?
Right.
They can just keep doing the same thing. I'm going to mail you an invoice. Who wants to get an invoice by mail? Nobody, right? Just send me an email. And you know, now they're trying to do new things like the previous world ordering directly from them. I have a buddy of mine that's a beta tester for the system, and he sent me some screenshots of it, and it looks interesting. It looks fairly well done, but it doesn't look like something that would be out in 2019, right? It may be something that came out in 2010. It would be fantastic. But I think in terms of the way it looks and the way it works, it's way behind. And I do wonder if it's because they just don't really have the staff to work on that, number one. And two, like, don't really need to put a whole lot of effort. Because there are other companies doing this kind of thing, like the Comics Hub. I know that they have a fairly good number of shops using that. It's an independent company. They use Diamond data to create order forms, but it's not done through Diamond.
Right. I don't know. This is something else I've talked to Jeremy, my LCS owner, about. Maybe I should interview him sometime.
You should. That'd be great.
I asked him about this, and he says, I said, are you interested in this? He goes, well, I may be, but I've gotten almost no information from Diamond on how it works or what to do. Basically, he said, I would have to send him all the information of all that I've got on you for my pull list, you know, including name, email, telephone number. I'm like, why? Why does Diamond need to know my email and telephone number? And I, you know, I don't, I'm not, yeah, thousands of people have my email, but why does Diamond need that more? I don't want to start getting emails from Diamond directly, in other words. And so I'm kind of on it. I was like, no, I'm out. I mean, my pull list that I have with you works to my satisfaction. And what I order, don't get from you, I get from Cowabunga. And I'm satisfied with that. I don't need anything else. And I don't, I'm not sure this is going to fly because too many people are, you know, people hate change anyway, for the most part, or resistant to change. And people who've had the same old, you know, local comic shop pull box forever, are they going to want to go to Diamond? I mean, without showing me some extreme advantage to it, I'm not interested, personally.
So I think part of the reason for asking that kind of information is to ensure that you're getting books that you want and that maybe you pick up some books that you didn't know you wanted, right? So they can send you some kind of mailing list with new releases or whatever, text you when your books are at the store, something like that.
Right.
Which, I mean, it's not necessarily a bad thing, right? Because I don't know what kind of system your shop uses, but my shop just has a spreadsheet with names, phone numbers, and the books that you get. And, like, the spreadsheet's fairly recent. It used to be on a notepad. And, like, that's how they tell you that your books are there. If you have some way of reaching people through email automatically, we'll say, where they can be like, hey, you purchased Batman. Maybe you'd be interested in getting Batman and the Outsiders. Or like, you know, you like to read Elliot Rahal. Why don't you check out Cult Classic Creature Feature? You know, those kind of things. That could be interesting, and it could help the market. Again, going back to that point that I was making about sales charts mean nothing, because that doesn't tell the shop what their people, what their customers are buying. All it tells the shop is what Diamond thinks will sell well.
Exactly.
Right? Because when shops order, they don't actually order, well, I mean, a good shop owner will know exactly what their customer base is getting, and there are many of those shops. But there's those shops that don't have that knowledge or don't want to put that kind of effort into it. And so they'll just order Batman and DC, or, you know, Marvel and DC, because that sells. And then, like, you know, maybe I'll get, like, one copy of each Valiant and one copy of an Aftershock book, and I'll put it on the shelf in case somebody wants it. Well, how can you grow your business and your customer base if you don't market those things to your customer base? And a system like what Diamond's working on maybe could help with that. Maybe not. Again, like you said, some people don't even care about that stuff. They just want to get their books, and they're happy with the way that it works now.
Right. I don't know. It's so complicated, and I don't begin to understand half of it. I don't really have a business mind in that situation, but I know it's just, it's, you know, comic book shops, there's nothing about the whole business model of comic book shops that makes sense. You'd be better off, you know, getting a Taco Bell franchise if you wanted to go into small business, because you've got the non-returnability. You're constantly trying to figure out what your readership wants. And I know one of the things that was early on, like when the advent of the direct market came, when Phil Suling started Seagate back in 72, 73, whenever it was.
Yep.
This is when we were just starting to get comic book shops. It was still mostly indirect market newsstands. But the thing that he offered over, you know, he made it was, okay, non-returnable. So the shops would say, well, why would I want to go non-returnable when I can get stuff from a newspaper distributor? Well, the thing was, you couldn't get specific titles. Like a newsstand would tell his distributor, I want 100 comic books. And the distributor would pull off 100 comic books. You didn't know what titles you were getting from week to week. Yeah, they might put certainly, you know, the most popular ones. Yeah, I'll put some Batman in there or some Spider-Man. But you never knew. There's all kinds of stories you read about kids from the 50s and 60s, especially in New York City, who would get up, you know, one day and just take off on their bikes, and they'd go to the newsstand looking for their comic books. And if they couldn't find the one they want, they would ride to the next newsstand. And then they'd go to the candy store, and you'd have all over town. And then in comic, a lot of comic books publishers in the 60s, 50s started publishing newsletter, mail columns where people would write in saying, hey, I'm looking for a copy of Batman 186. Does anybody? And that began a sort of a network like that. Well, that was the thing that the direct market offered, was that you could say, I want 25 copies of Batman. I want X number of copies of this, that. So that offset the, risk of non-returnability. And right. That's kind of how the market started building. But
yeah. And then you're able to actually collect comics, right? Because before you couldn't collect comics, right?
Not easily.
You got whatever. Yeah, not easily. You got whatever was in the newsstands. When you have a comic shop that is stuck with all these back issues, you get a back issue market. And of course, we love that, right? Because you can go and be like, oh man, I haven't read this book in 30 years. Let me see if my shop's got it in a 50 cent bin or whatever. Or let me go on eBay and pick that run up. Whereas before you couldn't do that. But at the same time, I wonder how much that hurts getting new customers. Because I've told the story many times, even myself getting involved in comics in the early 90s, had it not been for a newsstand, I would not be reading comics. Because right. I didn't find comics in a comic shop. I didn't even know comic shops were a thing. I found comics by going to this little Korean deli by the subway in New York City that just so happened to have a bunch of comics there. And, I picked up Avengers and Captain America and Batman. Those are my first three comics. And then I got hooked. And somehow I found the Wizard magazine in that newsstand. And there was some article about comic shops. And I was like, I've got to find a comic shop. And there was no Google, where's the nearest comic shop? Somehow, just by pure accident, I ended up finding one a couple miles down the street. And then my habits changed. Because instead of buying, Captain America this month and Avengers that month and then Batman and, maybe a detective and whatever, Sleepwalker, I can go to the shop and I could get the same thing every month, right? And so I started buying a certain select number of series every single month instead of just picking up whatever looked cool on the newsstand. Nobody really puts comics in a newsstand anymore. Walmart's got the DC stuff. There's also Marvel bundles you can get at Walmart. It's like 10 comics for, I think it's like $6 or $7.
Right.
Which kind of annoys me because sometimes I'll go in there to pick up DC stuff and there's like stacks of Marvel books in the DC boxes. And I'm like, I'm sure DC pays for this space. You know what I mean? Like they shouldn't be putting Marvel comics there. But it's like in some little aisle, like off to the side and, I don't know who picks those up. If you don't know they're there, how do you pick them up? Right? The point of newsstand is you go in to get a cup of coffee or candy bar and there's a rack of comics there. You see them and you maybe pick them up. Like when Toys R Us was around, Alterna had their books there. And there may have been one or two DC books that somehow popped in there as well. But when Toys R Us went away, there's nobody that has comics on a newsstand.
No, not that I know of. And, because there's no, but even up until the late 70s, publishers were still producing two copies. There was the newsstand version and the direct market version. And that's, influenced some collectability. I don't know. Shooter talks about, I saw him on another interview that he was convinced that they could have, indirect market didn't have to go away. They could have had both, the direct market and the indirect market. But people just got so enamored with this new system, this way of doing business that, I can just get what I want when I want it. And that was another thing is collectors were starting with the indirect market, getting from newspaper magazine distributors, you didn't know when you were going to get your comics. There was no new comic book day back then. You might get them on a Thursday this week, and it may be another 2 weeks, and you get them on Monday, and just whenever they got to you. So, I think as the culture of the comic book store grew up and, of being able to go down and look for what you want, I think that just people completely forgot about the concept of, hey, going out to the newsstand and picking up a comic book. So.
Yeah. And I do wonder too, if if having distributors like this gave the industry like some false sense of security. Cause, you know, there was the distribution wars of the '80s, right? Which, I mean, basically led to the downfall of the whole thing and just us having Diamond now. But when people realized, like, I don't want to just deal with this one guy, like, I could be a distributor. I can't remember his name. Roman, I think is his name. The guy that started Maha Comics. He had his own distribution company for a while, right? He was one of the guys that wrote to Marvel or and DC and was like, I'm not dealing with these guys. Like, if you want to send me your books, you're going to distribute directly through me. And there were a lot of guys that had that same sentiment. That's when you got the whole ID thing, right? You had regional distributors, which seemed to work okay for a little while until it doesn't anymore, right? Because then you have to deal with all these different companies distributing comics. Of course, that's kind of how we got Diamond. Diamond used to be, oh God, what was the name of that company? Some weird name, like Jurzax or something like that. You don't have that in your notes, do you?
Yeah, Urjax. They were a distributor out of Baltimore, Maryland. They were one of the first competitors to Phil Suling and Seagate. And they got to be fairly big, but they fell by the wayside. There was Pacific Comics. And Big Rapids out of Detroit, which later was bought out by Milton Greep, and they turned that into Capital City Distribution.
That's right, Capital City. That was one of the last big ones.
Yeah, they were the last big one as in the 90s as Diamond started buying up. They got Pacific. Diamond was the largest. Capital City was the second largest. And then there was several smaller ones. And what finally did Capital in was that was the time late 90s when Marvel went, filed bankruptcy.
Yeah.
And coming out of that, they bought a small publisher called Heroes World out of New Jersey.
Yep.
And that's not to be confused with Heroes are not hard to find comic shop in Charlotte, North Carolina. And so Marvel bought them and said, they're our exclusive distributor. If you want to get Marvel Comics, you have to go through us. And Capital City saw the writing on the wall of exclusive distributorships, and they went to D.C. to start trying to negotiate a deal to get D.C. to go exclusively with Capital City. And there were some advantages to that because I think they were in Wisconsin, and they were the closest to the actual plant in Illinois that printed both comics for DC and Marvel. But in the end, DC ended up signing exclusive with Diamond and Capital. They held on for a couple more years, but they just couldn't compete. And finally they sold out to Diamond in 96. And that's when we went into the age of exclusivity of Diamond distribution.
Yeah. It's interesting that Marvel almost went under because of that deal.
Yes. It almost killed them. Because they bought Hero and there was a small distributor. They had nowhere near the physical plant, the number of trucks, the infrastructure. They had no way they could distribute all of Marvel's comics. They would have had to gone from like 0 to 100 in a couple of days, and they just couldn't do it.
Yeah.
And it nearly did Marvel in.
Yeah, the whole Marvel story is rather interesting. We should do an episode on the Marvel story. That'd be kind of fun.
That's a wild ride as well.
It's pretty wild from like the 50s before there were Marvel, right?
Yes.
Because that was when DC was, what were they called then? It was National, right?
National Periodical Publishing.
Yeah.
Or National Comics, whatever.
Yeah. They actually distributed through DC, and DC had put a hold on them. Like, they could only publish like 8 or 9 comics a month. And, that ended up biting DC in the ass when Marvel came around in the mid 60s. Cause they're like, you know what? Screw you guys. We're going to put out 1 million books a month. And, yeah. That ended up working out very well for them. But yeah. The whole thing with, the effect of distribution on Marvel in the 80s and 90s is really interesting. And to be honest, like, we wouldn't have the MCU now had it not been for that, right? Because you had who was it? Perlmutter that bought Marvel in the late 80s, early 90s, maybe.
Yes.
And like I heard a story once, like he didn't even know what it was. Like he thought he had bought the publisher of Batman.
Yes, he had no idea. Of anything about the comic. Didn't know first thing.
Yeah, he's like, yeah, I just bought Batman. They're like, no, you bought Marvel. He's like, ah, shit. Well, all right. and, you know, he bought it for peanuts. Even Disney bought it for peanuts. I think Disney paid like, well, peanuts now. Back then it wouldn't have been peanuts. But I think Disney paid like $4 billion for Marvel. Which, I mean, for like comics, that's a lot of money. Right, but then you also got to think Marvel's, you know, merchandising and TV rights and movie rights, so it's worked out pretty well for them. I mean, I'm sure like just Avengers Endgame paid for most of that purchase. You know what I mean? So they've done just fine. And DC had a similar story, but kind of in the opposite direction. And that thing's interesting too, because like, didn't DC try to buy Marvel at one point?
I think when
that bankruptcy came out, they almost bought them.
I think there was a deal. My memory is not serving me well, but I think so, yeah.
Yeah. Really interesting stuff. And, of course, now we have, you know, Comixology, and you know, you can get books and stuff on iTunes and whatever. I posted a chart today. It's not necessarily a current chart from 2019. I think that chart is from 2 or 3 years ago, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
But, you know, Comixology is only like 30% of the digital market. And that's crazy because, like, when I think digital comics, I think Comixology. But apparently that's not the case. Like, iTunes or Google Play Store account for like 30 or 40% of the market. So, like, that leads me to believe that a lot of people buying digital comics aren't necessarily like the typical comic fan. They're just maybe people that went and saw Captain Marvel at the theaters or Shazam or whatever. They're like, hey, I'm going to go buy this trade on iTunes and see what the comic's about.
Right.
And, you know, there's a lot of focus, I think, right now on publishers working within the trade market. And, you know, Scholastic is huge. I think Scholastic owns like 50% of the trade market. And that's why when you look at like the big selling like Marvel or DC books, it's stuff that like you wouldn't even think. Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur has been like huge for Marvel. It's like one of the highest selling trades. And like, do you know anybody that reads Moon Girl and Devil Dinosaur? No,
I don't. Not on top of my head, I don't.
Yeah, and the comics don't sell very well, but the trades are gigantic,
right.
Gigantic. And so we see a lot of focus on that. And I mean, it makes sense, but again, where does that lead the old school comics market, right? People that buy single issues.
Right.
That ends up being, I would say, dominated by collectors or speculators even.
I mean, people say, well, we're not bringing kids into comics anymore. We're not bringing young kids. Tell that to Raina Telgemeier.
Yeah.
You know, her books, which all come out as like trades, are selling hand over fist. Kids line up. I mean, you go to comic book conventions and kids are lined up 100, 250 deep to get her autograph. So you can't say that the kids are not interested, but they're not coming into the comic shop on Wednesday afternoon with their dads or moms or, you know, that kind of stuff. It's the market's changing. And of course, every year you hear the same thing. Periodical comics are dying. It's all going to go to trades and I don't know. And maybe it will at some point. I don't know. Maybe it'll all go digital at some point. Who knows?
And that's why I like Black Label, DC's Black Label. I know maybe there's been controversy in some of the books. Maybe they're not like the biggest sellers. Although obviously like White Knight, for example, is a surprise hit. Because I don't think they even wanted to publish the first one. And, like, that was huge. But just the format itself, right, like these bigger books, more adult-oriented, it might be a more niche market. But I think it's a market that needs to be served. Because not everyone is going to continue buying single issues for the rest of their life. You know, a lot of people will move to trades. I have many friends that have moved exclusively to trade. But Black Label does offer an interesting venue for new types of storytelling within comics, which I think is interesting.
Right.
I don't know if the books are always the best, aside from White Knight. But like I read that Harleen book today and I thought it was fantastic, and beautiful. Like I'm definitely picking that up at a shop. I want a physical copy of that book. And I think maybe that's kind of the distribution of comics going forward. I for years I wondered, like, you know, in 10 years, 15 years, is everyone just going to buy on Comixology or whatever? And that has proven not to be the case, right? Because Comixology and any digital distribution is still very small compared to print. But I do feel, and I've mentioned this before in another episode, I do feel like in 10, 15, 20 years, the comic shop is going to be a very different place. It's going to be kind of like going to a record shop and buying vinyl. You know what I mean? Like it's going to be a select group of people that still enjoy physical media, and that's the way that they want to get their product. But you're not going to be able to get, I don't even know, like Marvel probably puts out almost 100 books a month. DC puts out 60, 70 books a month. You know, so there's probably 500 comics being put out on a given month. Probably more, I would say, but we'll just go with 500. There's not enough people to support that, I don't think.
No. I don't know. I mean, it's in the whole thing with digital, you know, I make all bones about, you know, not liking digital, but it's not because I'm against it. I mean, my gosh, I worked in IT for 30 years. I'm not against technology. It's just, I don't think that technology has caught up. I mean, the way you read comics digitally, the guided view, I mean, it's not a satisfying reading experience for me. Now, when it comes along that they have the right kind of technology, and artists are not drawing for the digital medium, and they shouldn't really at this point. But I mean, you know, when it can change where digital becomes satisfying to me as a print, then I can change. I'll have no qualms about that, but it's just not for me. So,
yeah. And I mean, I don't want to kind of leave on a downer note, but there's been some interesting history of like antitrust lawsuits.
Oh yeah,
within distributors, right? So Urjax had one in, I guess, sometime in the 70s against Seagate, and that led to this explosion of distribution that led to an explosion of shops. When that lawsuit came out, I think there were like 30 comic shops in the entire country, and when Urjax won that lawsuit, it exploded. It went to like 3,000 shops within a couple months.
Right.
And of course, I don't know what the number is now, and new shops open up all the time, but new shops close all the time also. And I find it really weird that there hasn't been another initiative like that with Diamond. I think there may have been one in the 90s. When they became the sole person. And if I remember correctly, the outcome of the trial is, well, they're not a monopoly because the comic market is so niche that it doesn't really impact the rest of book distributorship.
Right. I don't even know if it went to trial. I know there was the U.S. government looked into it at some point. But yeah, they kind of found, no, they're not doing anything, you know. They're not cutting anybody else out.
Yeah.
Just that everybody else just flat out couldn't, you know, and you start getting bigger and bigger and people started signing exclusive contracts. You know, that was what it did. I mean, Diamond didn't put Capital City Distribution out of business. DC did when they signed an exclusive contract with Diamond.
Right.
Otherwise, they would still and could still be working, you know, today.
Yep.
So, you know, it's not that Diamond did any of this, and believe me, I'm not in love with Diamond by any means, but they're not the bad guy that a lot of people portray them. They just simply, I think, are way behind the times because they have no competition and no incentive to innovate.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, that's true. That's true. Any final thoughts, Jay, before we wrap this up?
No, I was going to ask you, have you read the book Comic Shop by Dan Guarino?
So I own it, but I have not read it.
It's a quick read, and actually the last third of it is just him writing profiles of about 40 comic shops across the United States and Canada. So
interesting.
It goes into a lot of the stuff. It's basically the story of the direct market, but you get a lot of stuff about distribution in there, and then he covers like 40 comic book shops.
There's a lot of really good books on the history of comics.
Yes.
I'm trying to think of, I can't even think of some of the top of my head. I remember reading that Marvel one and I was like, holy crap, like this is like a mafia movie.
Yeah, that's Marvel, The Untold Story.
That's the one, yep. That book is crazy.
It's good. Men of Tomorrow is good.
That's really good, yep.
I read one recently that I didn't like as well. It's called Slugfest.
I haven't heard of that.
It's like it's pretty new. I think it came out in 2018. Slugfest, the 50-year world battle between Marvel and DC. And the it's a good book, but the writer says in the introduction, he goes, "I read mostly independent comics. I don't have a dog in this hunt. I don't have preference over one of the big two over the other." And then he goes on to write essentially a Marvel fanboy book.
Oh my god!
it's pretty obvious who he, you know, sides with in that book. But, you know, they're out there. But those three, you know, we mentioned. Oh, and the 10-Cent Plague is also a great book.
10-Cent Plague is good.
If you want to learn about the comics code and how it
destroyed emasculated comics.
Emasculated it for 20 years. So.
Yep. Yeah, that's my least favorite part of comic history, because that's when horror comics kind of became crap.
Yep. Well, it drove a whole company, DC Comics, right out of business.
Yep.
Except for Mad Magazine.
Yep.
And that's how they got past it, because they went to magazine format.
There was another publisher. When EC went under, there was somebody else that bought, like, some of the rights to EC, and they managed to actually put out, like, a hardcore, like, horror book into the mid-80s before they went under. And I can't remember what that company was. I'll have to look it up.
Right.
But, yeah, really good. God, the 10-Cent Plague. That book's amazing.
It really is. It's really good. All these are available on Audible, too, I think. So if you're,
well, we're playing everyone's favorite game, Martin Buy Stuff While Recording. I just bought a copy of Slugfest, so.
Okay. Like I said, it's good. I didn't think it was it's not as even-handed. And it's also a pretty quick read. It's not that long, really, so.
Oh, I might need to get this one, The League of Regrettable Superheroes.
That's a good book. That talks about all the Superman knockoffs. Back when Superman became popular, everybody wanted.
Yeah.
I mean, there was dozens and dozens of publishers that sprung up, all wanting to try to emulate what DC had done with Superman. And they came up with some of the craziest characters. I don't have a copy of that, but I've been through it. It's a good book. There's a companion to it also, the League of Regrettable Villains, I think.
Nice. I'm going to have to pick both of those up too. CJ, I didn't plan on spending any money tonight. Now I'm buying books.
Well, I never plan on spending money when I talk to Ronnie Barron, and then he starts sending me eBay links.
He's the worst. And yeah. Oh, yeah, and there's a League of Regrettable Sidekicks. Interesting.
I forgot about that one. That's the third, I think, in the series. Yeah.
All right. I'm going to have to buy all three of these tonight. Dang it. All right. Very good. Let's wrap this up, Jay.
Okay.
Thank you, Jay, for coming on the show. You are always a treat.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate the conversation.
Anytime. Of course, you can find Jay on Twitter at Jay Lovin. You can find him on the Best of the Rest podcast, available on all your favorite podcast catchers. Whatever. You know what I mean. And on nerdlegion.com. He can also be found on the Batpod, where you can find me and Bill Beer, where we talk about Batman sometimes. All the times. And that's it. I'm at Geekvine. The show doesn't have a Twitter, so just email yale@comictalk.today. I'll be back at the end of the week. Thanks for listening. Catch you on the next one.